Amish the Buddha, Amish the Dharma, Amish the Sangha. So good morning again. So this is a talk about our spiritual practice, our Zen practice, and how it supports us in addressing racism, inequity, and oppression based on race, the suffering caused by the racial divide in our country, our world, how we can explore our own racial identity and our own very personal response and experience with this. So that's where we're headed, right? This feels risky. It feels fraught with possibilities for misunderstanding. That first sentence took a long time for me to write. And it's sort of emblematic of this whole talk of how do we begin, right? I had to write the little blurb for the e-bulletin. Took forever. It's like, how do I consolidate this down? And I was just looking at the incense up there, and I noticed that usually I try to make like a little line with my incense, and I noticed it's like all over the place up there this morning. And I thought, oh, that's a little bit like my mind, a little bit like a little bit about how this talk may possibly go. I'm going to kind of grab from here and there, but it feels important to begin a conversation about how do we include looking at the history of race, looking at our own experience with this. How does it figure in with our spiritual practice? Where do we start? I think there's a lot of individual journeys with this, but not a lot of dialogue with each other. And so this is feels like a little bit of a timid wading in to this, but we'll see. We'll see where this takes us. So as I said, this feels like a risky topic, a difficult topic, partly because, and I just want to acknowledge like why, what makes it so challenging and difficult. Part of it is because we all have different experiences of racism and race, and we all have different definitions going on in our head, what we mean when we're talking about that. And because of those differences, there's a lot of potential for both being misunderstood and misunderstanding each other. And because of that, it often silences us. We often don't start at all because it's so fraught and feels kind of dicey. So how do we begin to talk with each other about where we're at with this and what we can do? There's enormous suffering based on racism. Our practice is about meeting the suffering of the world. So where do we start? So I'll give you a little framework for where we're headed with this talk. I'm going to share about my own personal journey with this, about explicitly addressing racism, coming to a clearer understanding of the impact of it, and looking more at my own racial identity. And I share this with you to stimulate some thought about what this looks like for you now, where you would like it to go, what it could look like. My story is not, I have this in bold, it's not a template for how to do this. I offer it as like my story, but it's not like necessarily your story or where I'm even suggesting you go with this, but just as one example, but not a template. So there's three things I'm going to talk about. One is I'm going to share just a bit about my experiences through a program that I did through my workplace called Courageous Conversations About Race by Glenn Singleton. So this is the text that we use. I'm going to read one passage out of that. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the program that many of us did here at Brightway called Awakening to Whiteness, and talk about what that is a little bit and about my own response to that. And I'm hoping, I see lots of people that were part of that with me, so I'm hoping those folks will share a little bit about their responses to what that work was like for them. And then finally, I'll just offer some thoughts about how our core practices support us in this work, how it all begins together. So as I was reviewing the talk this morning, I realized one thing that that might be helpful that I had not included was just some definitions. Like, so if we're going to, I think, as I said before, it's easy to misunderstand each other when we talk about these things. So I'm just going to read a couple things that help to clarify what we're talking about when we're talking about race and racism and racial justice. So bear with me, they're very short, but I think it's helpful as a way to bringing us together, like what are we talking about? So from Glenn Singleton, he defines race as this way. It says, I refer to race as the socially constructed meaning attached to a variety of physical attributes, including but not limited to skin and eye color, hair texture, and bone structures of people in the United States and elsewhere. Thus, racism, generically speaking, can be defined as beliefs and an enactment of beliefs that one set of characteristics is superior to another. Continuing this with this decontextualized definition, a racist would be any person who subscribes to these beliefs and perpetuates them intentionally or unconsciously. And he goes on to add one thing that I want to read. I believe that racism is the conscious or unconscious, intentional or unintentional enactment of racial power, grounded in racial prejudice by an individual group against another individual or group perceived to have lower racial status. So that's a dense definition, but I think it's helpful in terms of just like what is it that we're talking about. Another work that I have drawn on and highly recommend, I'm not all the way through, but it's really quite excellent so far, of The Inner Work of Racial Justice by Rachel McGee, who is out of the California area and a student of Norman Fisher. And she offers her definition of race, of racism, and her definition of racial justice. So slightly different focus here. Racism operates in obvious and non-obvious ways that render the target of the behavior vulnerable by degrees to disrespect, disadvantage, harm, or even death. Racism, in my view, is not limited to individual bad actions based on intent to harm others, nor is it limited to those individuals who consciously endorse beliefs about inferiority of others. Racism encompasses both explicit and implicit beliefs and acts that justify the assertion of power, individually, collectively, or systemically, against racially maligned people and their white allies, so as to minimize their freedom, access to resources, and sense of value in the world. So, now turning to what she is talking about when she uses the word racial justice, which is, I think, helpful. And it also ties in with how does mindfulness and spiritual practice come into this directly? She says, racial justice, then, is about taking actions against racism and in favor of liberation, inspired by love of all humanity, including actions at the personal, interpersonal, and collective levels. I love that. Inspired by love of all humanity. Opening the heart. Then she says, why might it be appropriate to consider engaging in racial justice as an aspect of living mindfully? The short and simple answer is that racial justice, like compassion, is just one form of an ethically grounded, mindful response to suffering in our lives. Moreover, mindful racial justice seeks to alleviate not merely isolated incidents of racial suffering, but all suffering caused by racism, including suffering that is very hard to see. This necessarily presents a profound invitation to a lifelong practice of awakening that seeks greater liberation and justice for all. Racial justice cannot exist apart from the effort to alleviate the socially constructed, unevenly distributed suffering of all marginalized people, or what I would call social justice. And social justice cannot exist apart from racial justice. So, opening the heart, liberation for all beings. All right. So, one thing to add before I begin, a little bit about my story. So, I just came from a conference about trauma-informed care, so trauma-informed practices, and how we acknowledge the impact of trauma and design systems and ways of being that support people in acknowledging the impact of trauma. And I just want to acknowledge that the topic of race and racism can be triggering. So I just encourage you to take care of yourselves in this if you find yourself triggered in any way. Just do what feels right for you, and just acknowledge it's a triggering topic. And this is also an opportunity to stay grounded and centered in yourself and notice your own reactions to this, right? Notice ways that you might be feeling, emotions that arise, body sensations, so bringing that mindfulness as you receive the talk. So just those couple of things. And one last kind of umbrella for this whole topic that I want to mention is, some of you may have heard me talk about this before, but I often think of Zen practice, my own practice, spiritual practice, as this kind of ways of expansion and contraction. So I think of practice as this continual expansion of the view and an opening of the heart. And so wherever I am and wherever you are, there is this, there are times of contraction and hurting and closing off the heart, but I work towards this expanding the view of what is possible, what aspects of enlightenment can be made manifest in myself and in others. It's just expanding that view and finding the places that the heart is contracted and closed and opening. So that's what this is about. It's about expanding the view, expanding and opening the heart. And it connects very directly with our four bodhisattva vows, and the first of which is, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. So looking, this work connects to deeply looking at how we do that, how we meet that. So I hope this talk inspires a little bit of a connection with that vow. So I'm going to start by taking us back to 2017 and the weekend of August 11th and 12th when violence erupted in Charlottesville. So many of you will remember that, and that's when white national groups, Unite the Right, and other hate groups gathered in Charlottesville demonstrating against the removal of Confederate statues. And I remember watching those images from the demonstrations and the counter demonstrations with just shock and horror, to see these shouts of hate and divisiveness, and to see torches being carried through the streets at night was really a shocking image to me. Such open displays. So I feel like even sharing that with all of you is a little bit tricky, because in sharing how shocked I was about that, I don't mean to, it's a little bit about my own blind spot. Like, those things are going on all the time, maybe in smaller and lesser degrees, right? But for me, that was a jolt. That was a jolt. So as I was absorbing those images, I felt moved about, like, what can I do about this? Like, this is erupting in a way that felt different to me. And again, this is sort of acknowledging my own blind spots. Before, I think a lot of the conversation in sort of my circles was about implicit bias and microaggressions, but here this was this overt, open expression. And that was really shocking. So taking that all in, with just a lot of disbelief and horror, and then I got this email from work that was asking for people to volunteer to be part of a cohort that would go through this curriculum, Courageous Conversations About Race at Work. So they're looking for volunteers for that. And it specifically was about addressing education and racial inequities that show up in educational outcomes. And so those two events happened within like a week or so of each other. And I thought, yeah, I want to volunteer for that. I want to give me something kind of concrete, local, I can actually do, right? I can participate in that. So, and it would be like 2 years of monthly meetings for about 3 hours. So I was thinking, yeah, so I'm going to talk to my direct supervisor, my boss, about participating in this, and met with her, and I was sort of brimming over with thoughts about how so I could share this information with my team, and this was going to change how I worked with families, and you know, we could be starting to make some changes and implementing and identifying our blind spots as a team. And I'm kind of brimming over with all this, talking to my supervisor, and she listened, and then she kind of sat me down and she said, okay, you know, that's great. Remember those ideas, and I did this work a couple years ago, this very same curriculum, and she said, and I kind of had that same idea about this outward, like I'm going to do something out there. And she said, it starts by self-inquiry. It starts by spending a lot of time looking at your own relationship to race, your own experience of race, filling in a lot of gaps about history that you never learned. So she said, that's great. Like, that's where we're headed, making system changes, thinking about that. She says, you're going to spend two years doing the hard work of looking at yourself. And I was really surprised to hear that from, I'm not particularly like close with the supervisor, but she said, like, so just know you're going to do that work and you're not really going to be bringing anything back to the team for 2 years. Right. So just chill on that. But do the work, like do the work. And the goal of where I work is that everybody would go through this curriculum eventually. And that's like, I'm impressed. It's a big investment of time, and it's expensive to have 3 hours for, you know, there was probably 30 of us in this cohort. So that was my first, wait, this isn't about out there, right? This is about, it partly is, but it's about like me understanding myself better. And that was a bit of a surprise. And she was right about that. There was a lot that I didn't know what I didn't know. I really filled in a lot of history that I'm still working on filling in about the history of slavery and lending practices and how this perpetuates today. And I'm still doing that work and considering my own racial identity, which I'd never even really phrased it that way before, right? I'm kind of part of the mainstream dominant white culture. And so realizing, oh, I hadn't really considered what that means for me and how I've moved through this world in a different way than someone who looks different might have done. So that was an important work, still working on that. So in the course of doing this, we got some really great tools to begin. And I was, I mean, talking about race and racism at work, right? That's like, that is just like, feels like a minefield for misunderstanding. So it was very tightly facilitated, and we had lots of tools to help us address this. And I wanna share share one set of tools, because it was super helpful for me to acknowledge these things. And it's something that, it's really helpful. So every time we met, we talked about the four agreements. So the four agreements were this. They were stay engaged, speak your truth, experience discomfort, and accept and expect non-closure. So I'm going to say a little bit about each of these because I think it's kind of helpful as you approach this. So the first one, stay engaged, was an acknowledgement of how difficult it can be to stay with this topic, right? And it's easy to kind of veer off into other injustices and other things that are easier to kind of talk about and address in our own minds. So it can be triggering and difficult to stay with it. So this is an acknowledgement and encouragement to do just that. Speak your truth was an encouragement to speak from your own personal experiences and be really honest about your thoughts, your feelings, and experiences. As I said, so often it's fraught with fear of saying the wrong things, and so we're often silenced. So this was an encouragement to speak your truth, but also an encouragement to speak your truth and not somebody else's truth, right? So sometimes it's easier to talk about what happened to somebody else or something going on out there, speaking from your own personal experience. The next one is this agreement to experience discomfort, which seems a little bit odd, but also an acknowledgement that it's uncomfortable to dive into these issues, and an acknowledgement that you will experience discomfort as you look closer, and most people do, and it's okay, and keep going. So it's like when we came into this cohort at work, we all kind of agreed that we would be experience discomfort, and we would be okay with that and not complain about that or like, no, this is too whatever. And then the last one is accept and expect non-closure. So this is an acknowledgement that when we bring up a topic related to racism and race, sometimes you get a little stuck in the conversation, right? And you want to get kind of somehow either solve it or come to some kind of action item or some kind of resolution. And or if you just kind of get locked in with somebody and you can't really conclude it very elegantly, to just accept that it's sort of this never-ending conversation, that you're often not going to get to this nice, neat place of having an action plan or agreeing with each other or any of those things. For me, I tend to jump into sort of problem-solving mode and action items too quickly, and this was a way to let that go a little bit, except that it's not going to be necessarily solved in the way that I think that it would be. So that's a little bit about that curriculum, which was really helpful. There was a whole bunch of other tools that were super helpful. But I want to touch on the experience I had here at Bright Way participating in a program called Awakening to Whiteness, which is kind of a nationally developed curriculum that we met as a group monthly over the course of 6 months. It was like January to June. And we went through a specific series of readings and discussion topics and then came together and talked about them. So I just want to touch on what those topics were, especially if you're considering about doing this when we offer it again. So the first meeting was entitled Why Are We Here and Personal Experience with Race. Next one was Historical Racism. The third one was Historical, Institutional, and Structural Racism. The fourth one was Awakening to Whiteness, and I'll read a little bit about the description of that one. Actually, basically, what that one was is what does it mean to be white in this culture, and acknowledging that. And then the fifth one was applying our spiritual practice, and then the last one was going forth about how to continue the work and what to do. So all of this information is still up on the Bright Way website, and so there were readings and videos that we watched each month before the meeting. And then when we met, we had a series of discussion questions based on the readings that we responded to. And just to give you a sense of the flavor of this, so facilitation at each meeting was rotated among the participants, so there's just kind of this printed out agenda that we followed. And one of the things that was, I think we talked about most in terms of procedure, and that was a bit challenging, was not having any crosstalk, right? So there's, we read, we came, and then there would be a question, and then we would go around and respond to the question or the statement. And as someone shared, then the rest were engaged in deep listening and just receiving what was said. So I know for me, the challenge was it either triggered something that I wanted to know more about what they said, so I wanted to ask about that, or it triggered either a memory of a similar experience or some kind of response based on what somebody said, right? So I was just, I really did have this impulse of like let's throw out the rules because I want to just ask you about this or I want to talk to you about this. However, it ended up being for me, I think, something really important in terms of my own capacity to share honestly about my responses, because gave the freedom to really respond and share my thoughts and my emotions without this even subconscious or unconscious thinking of like, if I say this, am I going to have to explain it? Am I going to have to defend it? Am I going to have to respond to a question about this? I don't know that I'm ready for that. I just want to say it, right? And so it really gave the freedom to just like, this is my experience. I'm actually still processing as I'm talking out loud with you, right? It helped me to be able to process out loud a little bit. So that was an important part, but it was tough. It was tough because there was things that people shared that you definitely wanted to know more about. But an important part of being witnessed in our experiences and offering that experience to others. There's a way that I went a lot deeper by being able to share my responses than I do when I'm just studying at home, right? It just brought that processing deeper. So this course will be offered again. I think we're in the process of getting some folks that would be willing to coordinate that. So I'm not exactly sure in the timeline, but if you're interested in this at all the readings and the links are up on the website, and there's a zillion resources, and it's really great to go through. So the last thing I'll share is about how Zen practice supports us in this work specifically, how it supports us in opening our hearts, looking at ourselves, actively working to decrease suffering that happens because of racism. Our Zazen practice, our core root practice, right, supports our ability and our capacity to stay present, to stay with. So that's our core practice of being able to stay with strong emotions, sensations, and now, I always liken Zazen to doing reps, right? So we build up our muscles, our capacity for doing that, for staying with. And that's our core practice, right? Anything can come in. Also, our practice of metta, which I think many of you are familiar with, is so it supports in this opening expansion of the heart. Opening towards our own, whatever our own suffering in relation to race has been and the suffering of others. So sending out a sincere wish for the ease, the safety, and happiness of others is important work. And I know when I have deeply engaged in metta practice, the surprise of that and the gift of doing metta practice is showing me where I can't do that, like where my heart has been closed. And asking that question, what hinders the wish? What blocks the wish? Why can't I look at this? Why is this hard? And gently opening. So it gives us the capacity for doing that. So the last thing I'll mention is that our Zen practice, and specifically our practice of working with the precepts, and the other tools that we have for looking at our reactive patterns, looking at our conditioning, looking at our habit energy, helps us to build the capacity to see our blind spots. So doing that work really helps us cultivate, I forget which teacher mentions this, lots of them I think, cultivate the pause, right? Cultivate the ability to stop. And instead of reacting in our perhaps unwholesome, unhelpful ways, We have the capacity to notice what is arising and choose something different. So these are fundamentally supportive practices in looking at our own experience of race and racism, and then helping in this world, in this really difficult time. So, as I said at the beginning of the talk, this is just a beginning, just an introduction. One of the agreements is accept non-closure. So that's the end of the talk. So thank you all for being here and you're listening to Open Hearts. It's not an easy topic to dive into, and so I would welcome comments, and I'm hoping especially that those that were part of the Awakening to Whiteness group might volunteer some of their experiences with that. So, thank you.
I'd like to volunteer my experience. Like you, I had some experience in a cohort about racism that caused me to do a lot more self-education. And so when this was offered, I thought, I don't need that. They can go. I don't need it. But then I read the description on our website, and I think maybe intentionally you allowed the first class readings to be available. I can't remember. Or maybe I just figured out a way to Google some of those readings, I really began to understand that it was really about my practice. This was going to make me a better practitioner of Buddhism. So that was one thing I wanted to share. And the other thing is, I have also experienced a lot over many years of the rule of no crosstalk. So much so that I sort of took it for granted. And it was the thing that made this 6-week experience work. Because I found myself saying out loud things that I thought I would never say. It was very, very powerful. Even if you don't think you need it, do it anyway. It is not to be missed.
Thank you.
I was raised in Indiana, Indiana has more Ku Klux Klan members per capita than any state north of the Mason-Dixon line. And my father, when he was in college, my father was president of this fraternity, and he pledged, the first black man that was ever pledged to a fraternity at the college that he went to. My father was active in the NAACP, and I saw Martin Luther King at Notre Dame when I was, 12, 13? I just assumed that I was educated until I married somebody of non-white color. And I had no idea about how oblivious I was. For me, the big curse of being white is that how I see the world is right. And I was, like I said, I was blind. But the writer Annalise Schaeff said, it's not am I racist, it's how am I racist. And to this day, my wife points out, Rick, there's tons of bias in what you just said. And the more I'm open to the possibility that this woke boy might be racist, not a day's gone by in the last week where I haven't had a just completely racist reaction to some interaction with another human being. My first thought is embarrassing. And it just comes, it just flows out of the culture that I was raised in. It's just, yeah. When Black Lives Matter first came out, my barber's African American, and I asked him about it. He just shook his head and he says, you white people. He said, you're all upset, and this is our everyday reality. Everyday reality. Every time my wife goes shopping, she goes follow in the store. Unless I'm with her. And then it doesn't happen. It just wouldn't occur to some, the staff to follow me. It wouldn't occur to them to not follow. I've never been stopped by the police. She gets stopped every other year. I'm blind. And until I had her to mirror for me how blind I was. Thanks.
So I just want to say that, if it's okay, Tomio, that the Awakening to Whiteness class was not, I couldn't do it. I was not allowed to do it. Because I understood that if I did it, white people wouldn't be free to say what they wanted to say because they would always be aware that there was a non-white person. The conversation would not be as frank, maybe. So even in this conversation, in this, I'm thinking this is addressed to white people. The only non-white people is the Buddha and me here in this room. My bias is I would not have been, even non-white people of course have their own racism and their bias. For me, I'm comfortable here because it's a religion from India. If it wasn't, I don't think if it was, because if it was a church, there would be an extra layer of racism there. Because this is a white religion, even though Jesus was Middle Eastern. But I just want to bring up the fact that whenever there's a conversation about awakening to whiteness or racism, I feel like I'm not included in it. And Rick having a non-white wife brings it home what it means to be racist. Otherwise, it's just an intellectual conversation. So, just want to put it out there.
I'm so glad you did, right? I'm really glad you did. And that's what I was trying to touch on at the beginning, like, because this is like my perspective. I'm going to have blind spots. How do I be inclusive? I guess it's a starting, you know? And the other thing, I think, with the awakening to whiteness, I think there is an element of, like, allowing people to be really frank without, just really frank. But the other thing, I think, that is, and I've seen this kind of happen at the cohort at work where a person of color is called upon to represent the thoughts and feelings of all people of color, right? And so then that's a really uncomfortable position, like potentially to put you in, like, so now what's that perspective, right? And you're representing like an entire huge group. So that's not so great either, but thank you for bringing that.
I'm not representative of American
racism, right?
And
exactly. Exactly. That's so we don't want to put you in that role.
Right. Never understand the depth of their suffering. I'd never be able to because I haven't experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
So just because my skin is different.
Yeah.
So it's
tough, right? Because we come at it from all these different perspectives. And one thing I learned through my work thing is that people identified as a person of color that I don't know. And I was like, oh, surprise, I didn't know that about. You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, they're coming at it from this whole thing that I made all these assumptions based on appearance, right? So learning my own blind spots. So I kind of wade into this, just like, I have a lot of blind spots. I'm working on it. We're working on it as a community. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's very admirable to, the first time I knew I was a person of color is when I applied to a private school for my kids, and the admissions person said, you know, you have an advantage because you're a person of color. And I said, what am I? And then I said, wait a minute, Roberta, I said, my kids are getting here because they tested on the top. I'm paying for tuition. Don't make it like an advantage, like, you know, that I'm here, person of color. Something about that really bothered me.
Sure.
So I don't know what it was. I've never investigated it. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I'm doing you a favor. No, you're not, right? You think you are because you're white and I'm not. But actually, if you look below the surface, it's an equal thing in this place.
Right. So, yeah. A lot of layers.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say a little bit about my experience of the Awakening to Whiteness, which I participated on, and as Shinta did, we weren't teachers in that. We were just participating like anyone else. I mean, and the lessons are at two. You know, I would have to do 3 Dharma talks to even touch on them. But I think what I appreciated about the fact that it was for white people. It's our problem. Mm-hmm. We need to examine it. And the value of it being just white people was, frankly, it wasn't. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of horror and shame. And to be able to explore that was difficult. It's very difficult, mm-hmm. but very valuable. And I think what it did for me was, I thought, all right, you know, like many people, like, I know this. I'm not racist. I know what's happened. We had this slavery thing, it was really bad, and I know since then some people are prejudiced. But oh no. We really don't know. We really have not been educated in how since slavery ended, it has just been a relentless series of different ways that the different forms the oppression has taken. And it continues to this day with mass incarceration and police brutality and, you know, it's just a non-stop, relentless assault on the people of color in our country. And so recognizing how it's still happening, and many of the, or some of the things that we read in this particular curriculum, it's also about Portland and Oregon. Mm-hmm. So seeing how, like, Oregon is one of the most racist states outside the South. It was going to be a white man's heaven. It was a non-slave state, but that was actually for more political and economic reasons. It had nothing to do with a lack of reason. So this kind of, whew, and I think the best things that have come out of it for me are a willingness to explore this and be wrong. So that's a decrease in what is called white fragility, where we're so defensive, we don't, to be called racist is the worst possible insult, right? We're not, we know we're not that, we're a decent person. But to realize, like, but we're ignorant and blind and we make mistakes, and like, we're not gonna be able to explore this without making those mistakes. And that doesn't make us an evil person. That makes us a part of a system that has been racist for ages. And so to explore that and not realize that doesn't make me an evil person. If I make a mistake, if I'm ignorant, if I stick my foot in it, I mean, I'll try not to, but it's essentially unavoidable if we start exploring this territory because we're so unfamiliar with it. So that willingness to, that humility, that willingness to make mistakes, as opposed to just like, you know, maybe seeing a person of color walk in for the first time just thinking like, oh boy, you know, all these minefields about like, you know, trying to be, do everything right, and just realizing, no, I'm going to do stuff that's wrong. So it's more of an open sense about it. And then also this is where practice really comes in. It's our practice is all about deconstructing self. Our sense of who we are, challenging our sense of who we are, seeing our assumptions so that they don't bind us. And so this helped me recognize, like, no, I do have a racial identity. My race is extremely important and impactful to my experience as a person. And so that has been like, oh my, well, that challenges some ideas about myself. But that feels completely consistent with practice. And then practice helps us, like, well, yeah. So your whole idea of yourself might be turned upside down. Right, that's what we're looking for, right? So we get a sense of comfort with that and a sense that that's okay. That's actually, will be okay.
Do you think our generation should in any way be responsible for the sins of our father somehow, make reparations? Like they tried to do that with Native Americans. I don't know how that's worked out.
I would counter that question with, I get that question, totally get that question. What I learned is it's not about that. It has not ended. It has not ended. So yes, I am responsible. I am as 100% responsible as any of my ancestors in Georgia. Well, you can see how emotional it can get. The other thing I was going to say about the course, I wish it had been called Awakening to Privilege. because I was an advocate of it being open to everyone, that would have been even harder than the course was. But I will say, if you decide to take it, it didn't get really wonderful for me until the third class. So if you don't like the first one, do the second one. Because the reward is just so wonderful.
So we have time for just like one more, and then we're at kind of that time. But
I did just want to say one.
I am.
No, but I just want to clarify. I want to clarify that the course is open to everybody. It says explicitly on the website it is open to everyone. However, like if you are a person of color, you might want to take a look at what it's about. And I think of it as like if a bunch of you guys wanted to go around and meet and talk about toxic masculinity, I would say, you guys go for it. it's like this is us addressing a problem that we're responsible for. So, I mean, technically, I don't want to continue the system of white supremacy and exclude anyone from anything, but it is a little like, well, I don't know so much.
It's like if women got together and said, men are not allowed, women have discussed Me Too, that would be more similar to excluding people of color than white males get together and talk about masculinity. How would the males feel if we were getting together and discussing Me Too? That's more what I'm saying, that. So, you know.
So time for, there are two people that, so Pat, I'm sorry, forgetting your name, but yeah.
And just real quick, I just wanted to appreciate how much effort you put into definitions. One of the things that's, you used the word privilege in your last comment, but much of the time that we were talking, I was thinking about how difficult white privilege was to accept. And that's not the same as racism. That's a different thing. And so there's, as you start to unpack this, I think the care that we take with trying to be, say what we mean or what we're trying to say, is always going to be challenging. Yeah. But I think we, in our group, I think we swallowed several different times around the language of white privilege. It was really, really painful, even if we already believed it, even if we already understood that it was true, it still was really painful. Thank you for venturing into this topic.
Did you have?
Well, I just want to say very quickly, and not to negate this conversation, which I think is important, but I come from a racially mixed family via Hawaii, and so it's called Hapa there, and it's my extended family. And so I'm here to tell you that people of other races and cultures give as good as they get. There's a lot of family dynamics on the island, and you can't go too far because you've got a white auntie, that would be me, but you might not like white people. So I have had the privilege of experiencing being one down from the rest of the group when I've lived over there for 2 years, and So I'm the white auntie. And what it brings up for me is the idea that there's it's numbers of people versus each other, and the biological component for all of us, like fighting for resources. And you can identify people by color. And the reason there's not more mayhem in Hawaii between the races is that they've intermarried so much that you always have someone from that other race in your family, and there's a big cultural imperative that you treat people a certain way, even if they're white. And so that is a great experience.
Thank you for sharing that. And that's kind of that experience of not othering, right? Because we're all we're all in the mix, and that's what we're working towards.
Yeah.
So sorry we've run over time, but thank you all. We did offer I'll do the final offering. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we go to Buddha. All
throughout space and time, all honor ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha, rajna, paramita.
Thanks, Natalie.